Hello and welcome to Transmission. Today we're joined by Bex, who is the head of development at Field. We cover what has changed for Field since they were last a guest in 2023, how you develop battery storage sites, and particularly focusing on some of the regulatory changes in terms of Clean Power 2030 and connections reform. We take a site through from day zero through to operations, and we talk about the key challenges in that process. We also talk about how you can encourage a more diverse workforce into the world of batteries alongside other STEM areas. Let's jump in. Hello, Bex, and welcome to Transmission.
Hi, Ed. Thanks for having me.
And as always, let's start off with who you are, who are Field, and your role in the energy space.
Yeah, thanks. So I'm Bex. I'm the head of development at Field. Field is a developer, owner, operator, and now excitingly optimizer of grid scale battery storage. As head of development, I take projects through from origination, so finding the sites right up to handing them over to construction. And I also have another role sort of outside of Field hat, and that's I'm the chair of the planning working group for ReGen. And that's another really exciting role at a time when planning is a real challenge and sort of achieving CP30 targets.
I mean, there is just so much going on within the energy space in terms of the amount of wind, solar, batteries that we're adding to the system. Sort of planning development has never been kind of more critical than it is right now and for the next sort of 5 and 10 years. So it's a fantastic place to be. This is also not the first Field episode we've ever had. We had Amit on, and I was doing some preparation. Episode 13, back in March 2023. Have you seen that one?
Yeah, I have. I watched it back actually as prep, and really nice how much Field has done in that time. So when Amit came on, our first project is a 20 megawatt project, Oldham at Manchester, was just in construction. In those 2 years, we've now got 4 operational projects. So it's 180 megawatt hours. We've got another 6 in construction and pre-construction, 5 of those in the UK and 1 of those in Germany. So we've actually gone international in that time. And we've got a really big development portfolio behind that as well.
Okay. And that episode was particularly sort of looked like it was filmed in a jungle. It was kind of in deep in Shoreditch. There was a dog halfway through. It was, had a lot of excitement. I mean, today, I can't promise anything, but I don't think we're going to have a dog halfway through.
Yeah, it was very Shoreditch. But now, so another thing that happened is we actually did a really big fundraise. So we secured £200 million investment from CVC DIF, a Dutch infrastructure fund, which is funding the projects that we're currently building. And so with that, I guess we sort of, we grew up, we became a proper company. We now have a proper office and things like that. So yeah, there's a lot going on.
Very good. Okay. And so obviously your kind of key part of this is around the development of projects. So maybe we could actually just go through that sort of that process of taking a project right from day zero through to the point where you hand it over. So what does that look like?
Yeah. So batteries solve grid needs, right? So all of our work starts with grid analysis of where are these things needed. And grid need means in terms of constraint management. So where are we paying to turn off a lot of wind farms? Or where is there a really high stability need because there's a lot of renewables on the system? So we identify where in the system they're needed. And then also Field is, as I said, developer, owner, operator of sites. So ultimately, it's going to be us who goes on to build those sites. So we also consider constructability. So for us, an ideal site would be an existing substation with a spare bay. So you can just connect straight in there.
Okay. But most of, I mean, from outside of the development space, it feels like most of the substations with a spare bay, with a nice piece of land next to them have all vanished. So that's the hard part, right? Finding the sort of next best site?
Yeah, they are vanishing. And I guess we do have a couple. So Spittal, for example, that's right up in the north of Scotland, sort of John O'Groats. I actually now know the UK by substations, but realise that not everyone does. So right up in the north of Scotland. And again, that really fits in nicely with the high penetration of renewables up there. So some do still exist. There's also a lot of new substation build out as part of CP30. And then I think that also ties in quite nicely to one of the big things we're seeing at the minute of connections reform, of sort of trimming down that queue so that some projects actually can start to come online.
Okay. And I really like the, we'll come on to connections reform and CP30 in a second. But the one of the bits I really liked is kind of when you're describing what makes a site interesting or sort of a good opportunity, you didn't kind of say, oh, it's just like the ability to run like a wholesale power price, charge and discharge, because that's almost like that's the accepted business model for batteries. You're thinking about the extra stuff, which is, you know, where can we go above and beyond just shifting energy to meet sort of consumers' needs? We're also thinking about constraints. So how do we run the network better? And maybe there's a stability service that we can provide as well. So sort of within that one comment, there was a little bit of the evolution of the battery space onto batteries are just doing so much more today than they were maybe 3 years ago.
Absolutely. And I think that's something that not everyone realizes of like how much batteries can do and all of the different markets that they're operating in. And so I think another change that we've really seen since Amit's last episode is our latest site to go operational is Octoroar. It's a 50 megawatt, 2 hour site up near Loch Ness. And when Amit spoke about that site to Quentin and said 50 megawatts, Quentin sort of gasps and says like, whoa, big project. And you know, now we're looking at 200 megawatts, 400 megawatt projects. And then the other funny thing about that clip is, so that's our first 2 hour site. And Amit describes that as long duration. I mean, longer duration might have been better. But you know, now we're looking like long duration batteries really are a thing, you know, 8 hours plus. And with the technology moving on, batteries are now sort of competing with pumped hydro and things like that as real long duration assets.
Mm. And I think if you look back at, say, like 2016 documents around grid planning, things around, say, a 1 hour system was considered to be the absolute limit of where sort of batteries can get to. Now you're absolutely right. 8 hours feels very much within range. 8 to 12, kind of question mark, and then sort of longer than that, I think we're into mid and genuine long. Yeah. Maybe that statement will not last the test of time. Yeah. And we'll be here in 3 years' time. Yeah. Saying, oh, what an idiot. 24 hours was totally foreseeable. So yeah, very, very interesting. Let's go, I think really good to cover that. Let's make sure that we also pick up the elements you were talking about in terms of CP30 and connections reform. So if people who are not in the know on those things, like what are they, but also what do they mean to you as someone who's developing those projects?
Yeah, so connections reform, I've sort of lived and breathed it, as I think a lot of the industry have for the last sort of year. So I'll try and break it down into layman's terms. Basically, the UK grid system is highly oversubscribed. And so it's to cut down that, to remove sort of zombie projects. And I feel the industry, I think, fully support that. We need to... the right projects need to be able to come online quicker. And that's to, you know, support the build out of renewables CP30 targets. I think quite important in that is the use of the term right projects. So NESO described that as ready and needed projects, which again, completely agree with. I think one of the challenges that we're seeing is the process has moved very quickly. And as you've probably already picked up on from just the very brief intro that I've given, development is very complex and there are a lot of nuances. And I think there's a risk that because the process has moved so quickly that there may be unintended consequences as connections reform plays out. And to sort of to speak a bit more about that rather than sort of sounding a bit elusive is particularly the spatial maps. So they define the capacity that can be built out in each area of the UK. And again, field, but I think a lot of people in industry, so hopefully sort of a lot of listeners will agree, is that those spatial maps don't necessarily match actually what the system needs. So again, talking about the sort of the real high stability need in the north of Scotland, yet the spatial maps don't have the sufficient capacity within them to sort of allow for that. So going forward, you know, what can we do? I think NESO, Ofgem, industry worked really well together through the connections reform process. We saw changes come in as they listened to actually how does development work. And I think that has to keep happening so that, you know, the regulators really understand how the system works, how development works. And so the next opportunity, this is the strategic spatial energy plan, is the sort of how the spatial maps get refined. And so it's really important that collaboration continues so that the capacity is there to allow batteries to be, and other technologies, where they're most needed.
Quick break. If you listen to this show, then you probably work in energy. And at Modo Energy, we're not just talking about the energy transition. We help our users to actually make it happen. All energy storage, solar and wind assets on the global balance sheet need to be valued and benchmarked. And that's where Modo Energy comes in. Our benchmarks and forecasts are transparent, bankable, and trusted by the world's leading banks, asset managers, utilities, and developers. So if you want to learn more, go to modoenergy.com. And if you want more content like this, sign up to our weekly dispatch newsletter. Enjoy the conversation.
I think this is giving people a really sort of good overview of how do you think about developing in a particular location. So from the engineering principles of like the balancing needed through to the policy elements of, okay, well, some of this is centrally planned. So does it fit within sort of government and NESO's plans to build this out? I think the next element for me is, okay, so once you've got the rough central plan and the rough need, how do you, like, what is next in the development process? You've selected a site. It's near Loch Ness, and you say, right, I want to turn this into a battery. What do you do next?
Yeah, it's a nice little storytelling, actually. So hopefully it works quite nicely. So as you say, you've identified your site in terms of land and your grid connection. And so those two processes then run in parallel to ultimately get you to, you've got your grid offer in hand and you've got a signed land option. And actually that aligns with the Gate 2 process as part of connections reform process, right? Once you've got your land, you're classed as sort of ready. And that's when, from a development point of view, costs really ramp up. So for transmission level projects, which is where a lot of our greenfield portfolio is in the UK, when you accept a grid offer, you pay securities. So that's if the grid are doing sort of reinforcement works on behalf of your project, and for some reason you were to pull your project, they're sort of covered for that. And so a standard amount for that is you're paying £1,000 a megawatt. So you're paying £200,000 for a 200 megawatt site. And those payments are annual. So that's one side of it. Then the other thing is, okay, so how long is this process happening over? And as I mentioned at the start, fielder, developer, owner, operator. So we do a lot of work in development because ultimately it's going to be us who takes on those sites. And so we want them to be well developed and ready to go straight into build. There's also nuances. So there's different planning systems in different parts of the country. So the English planning system and the Scottish planning system are quite different. Scottish system being a bit longer. Those type of nuances that I said weren't originally reflected in the Gate 2 process. Anyway, all that is to say, development takes a long time from that sort of us first finding a site to planning secured. You're looking at sort of 4 years. Oh, in
wow.
Scotland.
Okay.
Yeah. So 200K a year, you can do the maths.
Yeah.
We're at £800,000. That's just on your grid, right? Then there's also the development and actually sort of planning side of things that goes along that. So field, we would do, in terms of sort of what does good development look like, we would do ground investigations on a site. So that's understanding the ground conditions. Does the site drain, or do you need like off-site drainage? What does your cut and fill look like? So what are your vehicle movements that then feed into your planning application? So that's sort of 60K, 100K there. Then you haven't actually started the planning application. So with preparation of your technical assessments, Scotland has a high planning application fee. It's about 350,000 to prepare and submit a planning application. So, you know, all in, you're sort of 4 years in, over £1 million a project. Yeah, it's an expensive business, and that's why I think the protections in the Gate 2 process for projects which have got planning submitted is really important, sort of recognise that level of commitment that projects have gone through.
Okay, and this is kind of even before you're even ordering the battery components that go onto the particular project, right? So this is just to get to the point of being ready to start ordering your components to start building.
Yeah, completely. And I think haven't even gone into there the sort of the challenges, or something I do want to get onto, the challenges and delays that we're seeing in planning, but it gives you some kind of idea of the timeline of these projects, right? So you're 4 years in the development phase, lead in times for really big transformers for sort of 400 kV equipment, that's 2 years. Mm-hmm. So when we're thinking about CP30 targets, they're projects that are, you know, in planning now, this change needs to happen right now to make sure that that's not further delaying things, because those targets are already looking hard when you look at these timescales.
So 4 years planning, then you're ordering components, that's another 2 years, and then you're actually constructing the thing, which is, again, we actually looked at this from a Modo perspective, somewhere between, say, we had sort of 16 months to 19 months as being a rough figure, but 2 years again. So you could almost say point to point, 8 years, if my maths is getting there. Okay.
Yeah.
And it's for something where we're adding so many battery sites so quickly, and sometimes it kind of, people look at development and they say, oh, well, someone's just chucked a load of battery sites out there and just, you know, tried to make everything stick type thing. Actually, that's just not true at all. There's this kind of 8 year process with millions of pounds involved in it to actually get just to the point of giving the government and NESO options to have this flexibility there. So I think that's a really fascinating part of the story. You also mentioned the protections that exist within Gate 2. Let's just kind of cover that off. So first of all, just Gate 2, just describe what that is. And then the protections, do you want to just describe what they are as well?
Yep, I'll do my best. So Gate 2 to the whole queue, as it's known, is the sort of the start of what is going to be a rolling process, but it's to trim down the current grid connection queue that we've got. So everybody, unless you're an operational project, has to reapply for their grid connection. And there are some protections under that. So projects that have an exactly, you know, I think it's a 2026 connection date, will automatically get their connection again, because obviously they're quite far through that procurement process. There's then a sort of series of protections beyond that. So if you've got, for example, a capacity market contract, or if you've passed FID, you also have some protections. And then the bit that we worked quite hard on is making sure that there's also protections then for those projects at the planning submitted stage, because as I just described, you know, you're 4 years in, £1 million deep. It's sort of, and you know, not too woe is me, you know, development is a risk, but if you've been doing development right and in the right places, it has taken you quite a long time to get there. And so ultimately now those projects are protected, which is great.
And so the Gate 1 and Gate 2, they kind of reflect the how far along, how advanced the project is. That's kind of the take-home message. And I think what's really interesting is kind of then you're right that the 26 projects will be protected and that they will kind of hold their date. Also the 27 projects will hold their date as well. I think there's a question mark that we've been thinking about from the Modo side, which is, of the projects which have land and land rights and planning, there are potentially quite a few projects coming through from the battery side. So maybe something like 40 to 50 gigawatts, which is quite a large number. If you go back to the CP30, so the Clean Power 2030 plans, government was saying, well, maybe 23 to 27 gigawatts of batteries we need. It looks like we're going to get more than that. And so the real sort of question mark seems to me on this is, okay, government, are you interested in listening that so many people have wanted to bring forward battery sites? Maybe we need to think about beyond 2030, how many more gigawatts of this are we going to build? I think that's probably a really kind of critical question, which is like, how many more battery sites do we want to add to GB? How do field think about that? Do you kind of look at the 23 to 27 gigs and think, well, that's done? Or do you think actually, maybe, or like it looks like we need many more gigawatts of storage on the system.
Well, so a bit of both. One, I think, goes back to my earlier point of we don't think those capacity pots are enough, and particularly in certain regions. So, for example, NESO have just announced a long-term stability tender to provide stability services. And from our analysis, they're currently aren't enough projects in the right locations that are going to get Gate 2 offers to actually match the stability need that NESO themselves have identified is needed. So I do think that there hopefully is going to be change there. The other point is accounting for attrition. So it's really hard to get a project to financial investment decision. You know, we have probabilities at each stage of drop off. So before you get your head signed, we say it's a sort of 50% chance and go, you know, and we had attrition, right? And the projects that we've brought online so far have been acquisitions. I cannot describe how many sites we have looked at and really analyzed. And there's only a handful that we've thought are actually sort of fit to build in terms of, you know, they're actually big enough, or all of the land rights are got, and you have all of the access that you need, or it's a good grid connection. And so I think that's something that's really been overlooked of like, yes, it might look like we have too much, but there's a very big difference between the number of projects with a Gate 2 offer and the number of those projects that are actually going to come online.
I think it's a fascinating part. So when you say the projects that are not going to come online, you're talking about this concept of attrition, that some of these projects won't actually be built and come through. But just to, before we kind of talk a little bit more about that, I think this idea of transacting on projects that aren't yet built, we hear the term a lot in industry, which is kind of quote unquote ready to build or RTB. What does that even mean?
Yeah, and that goes sort of again back to my point of like how many of these sites that we've looked at are not actually able to acquire or not wanted to acquire. So I think it's a bit of a loose term, and I guess it sort of depends on how good a developer you are. And so, as I keep on saying, because Field develop and build these sites ourselves, we're doing a lot of upfront design development work so that, you know, as you've heard, there is a really long time scale. We want to move as quickly as possible from planning into construction and ultimately into operation. So we probably set quite a high bar of that really is, you know, you could put a spade in the ground and go. That's not necessarily the case of if if you were going to flip on a project and you tried to get consent sort of as cheaply as possible, and maybe then you know that the design needs changing and there's some access right issues and things like that. So I think there really is a varying scale across market of what is a true RTB site.
Yeah. And I think then going on to the attrition side, so from your point of view, the sites that are really well thought through, really well planned and developed, those should be in a pretty good place from an attrition point of view. Those that have perhaps been rushed to get there, you think might have higher attrition, and so a few more of those might drop out. When you look at the plans in the future and you see maybe we've got 40 gigawatts at Gate 2, do you have a feeling of attrition being 1%, 10%, 50%? Do you have an idea of like where that number might be?
I'm not an expert on this, but we did some sort of back of the fag packet calculations. And I think the figure that we were quoting was about 1 in 7 projects, okay, as in make it through, not a trite. That's a word.
Okay. Yeah. I think it's, I mean, if it's not the word, then it's close enough. Good. Okay. So then we've kind of been spending a lot of time talking about how stuff develops, how it comes through the development process and then gets to this point where it gets built. You also mentioned that Field have sort of added on this ability to be operator and optimizer. And so do you want to talk about the journey you've made in terms of the optimization?
Sure. I'm also definitely not an expert on this. So there's a whole in-house optimization team. But at a very high level, we've launched Gaia, which is our in-house optimization platform. So that was a platform that was built in-house by our technology team to ultimately operate our assets for us. So it's monitoring energy markets, grid conditions, weather conditions, bringing all that information together, and then working out how best to optimize our assets. And it also monitors our assets to check that they're performing sort of as we're expecting them to. So that went live at the end of last year, really exciting. And we have Oldham, so the first project that we built, that's online and being optimized by Gaia now. That's doing really well. And so the plan is that we will bring more of our projects online onto that over the coming year.
It's one of those really big questions that comes up a lot, which is people who own assets or looking at the space say, well, hold on, when do I bring this all in-house? Should I bring it all in-house? And there's definitely some people going down the road of saying, nope, I really like the optimizers. I'm going to stay with the optimizers. And I'm very happy to not be in that space. There are definitely people who are looking at it and going, look, when I get to this size, and that's 300 megawatts or 500 megawatts, whatever it might be, they say, oh, I'm over a tipping point, and then I want to also do some of this optimization myself. The other example that springs to mind is Gore Street. They also do a bit of their optimization in-house as well. I'm discounting the utilities here, obviously, because they kind of do a bit of everything. But yeah, really interesting to hear the kind of field have made that shift. Let's go back to delivering battery projects, which you are very much an expert in. The key challenges then, if we were to kind of write down this top list of like what the challenges are, because I think from NESO's perspective, government's perspective, this is what they need to hear. So what are the key challenges? What do we need to fix?
Yeah. It is hard. It's very fun. I love my job, which is nice. There are challenges. So I think the biggest one, and it's nothing new, but it's planning. The planning is really struggling. We've got like an inefficient, unpredictable system. It's not a surprise. There's more infrastructure coming online than ever before. You know, we're asking local authorities to do more than ever and with less resource than ever. But I think there are solutions, and you know, planning can't be the reason or shouldn't be the reason that we don't meet CP30 targets. So in terms of, and I said, I'm chair of Regen's planning working group. I love the work that Regen do. I think they're great. And that working group, you know, is coming up with a lot of solutions, possible solutions. There is also, there's change in government coming. So the planning and infrastructure bill is currently going through. That's great. It's not going to happen quick enough. As I've said on the timelines, like the projects for CP30 are in planning now. I think, and even when the planning and infrastructure bill comes in, there's a lot of secondary legislation which needs to come with that, about, you know, how the process actually works. And some stuff that's really missing from the bill at the minute is things like statutory timeframes. And that's the thing that we have the problem with now, is like, you know, we aren't able to meet those. There aren't the timeframes, or we aren't able to meet them. And so what can we do short term now? I think it's really invest in planning. So when I first started in planning, sort of 12 years ago, some local authorities did offer PPAs. That's planning performance agreements, not power purchase.
Yes, I was going to say, it's like, very confusing acronym. Yeah. And what is a PPA in the planning world?
And so that is where you would pay a local authority for dedicated resource, and so that they would deliver within an agreed timeframe, so you had some certainty. A lot of planning authorities have stopped doing that, and I think that's mainly because they don't have the resource now. They just can't commit to those timeframes. But I really think something like that can still work. So for those that do have the resource, great. Allow, you know, I'm sure developers would absolutely throw money at it if it meant that they could guarantee their project was going to get through planning in a certain amount of time. You know, it would really increase investor confidence in the industry. If they don't, you can pay to outsource that. And, you know, that can be a completely independent consultancy, a preferred consultancy of the local authority's choice, so that it remains completely independent, but again, you know, sort of dedicating that resource. And I think another really important thing is skill set. So batteries is actually quite a new technology.
And this is not within, so you're saying within planning, there's kind of the PPA potential, or there's potential to sort of work with planning authorities to bring sort of more money into the process to move it more quickly. And there's also legislation coming as well. And then skill set is then moving outside of planning, still within the typical planning?
Yeah, so still within planning, I think There are some experienced people in planning, but if we're going to bring on this sort of host of new people into planning, they're probably not going to have that renewables experience. And also really, like, batteries are still quite a new technology. And so I think there's two things. One is that you train up those planners that are in-house in local authorities. And then another solution is that you could have this sort of like centralized hub of specialist renewable planners. And so it's sort of, you know, the local authority do their, okay, I get this. And as soon as it's sort of, oh, I'm not sure about this, like, how do you decommission a battery? What does that look like? They've got that specialist knowledge base that they can go to.
Yeah. If you're listening, GB Energy, this could be a good use of your money.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Okay. So going on from the planning side, what are the other big challenges that you see?
Yeah. And so this is probably my contrarian opinion is it's what's being called in the media sort of the uprising against renewables. And that's sort of the real change in local sentiment to renewable energy. And actually, you know, maybe that's been common in some parts of the country, and now we're really seeing that like everywhere. And my contrarian opinion is, I get it, if I'm honest. So I personally recently have been in some very threatening, very unpleasant public consultation events, and you know, that's not okay. But taking back from it and on reflection, anger isn't a primary emotion. It's a cover for something else. And so those primary emotions, you know, these people, they're scared. What does this mean for property prices of my house? Or they're sad. It used to be a nice hill out the window, and now it's a solar farm. I used to walk my dog there, and now there's a lorry delivering batteries. And so, like, I really do get it. And so what is perhaps an unpopular opinion in the industry is I think industry really needs to be recognizing those communities that are hosting this infrastructure, and they need to see some benefits from that. And that's particularly in relation to community benefits.
Okay. And I think I definitely hear where you're coming from, and the industry can sometimes get tunnel vision around stuff, which is that we're building solar parks, we're building wind farms, and we're building battery storage sites. And these are the things, by the way, that are taking gas off the system, they're taking coal off the system, they mean that we no longer have emissions in your communities. Like, these are the things that are going to make us an independent and clean power system. Doesn't everyone want that? And yet, like, we can get so tunnel visioned on that that we forget about some of the logistics of how we actually do the transition.
Absolutely. And I think we probably are looking at it from quite a biased point of view. You know, we get it. We really want, like, I'm really passionate about climate change. You know, we really want to hit these targets. If you look at it from tunnel vision of the other, like, people might not have that same passion. And actually, to go back to what I said, you know, what they see is my life as I know it is changing because of something that's out of my control and that you're doing to me.
I thought there was a really interesting article on BBC maybe a month and a half ago, where they interviewed some people who live next to a solar park. And I think it was interesting because it wasn't sensationalist news. It was like visiting someone who lives nearby, and they said, well, like, what's your experience to live next to a solar park? And they were like, it's no change, it's absolutely fine. Not sort of box office news that they were hoping for. But actually, I think perhaps some of the stories that need to come through, which is, I do definitely hear what you're saying in terms of, I think people definitely see the change and they are worried about the change. But also, I think perhaps in your contrarian view, you're saying, well, look, what can industry do about it? There's this element of, we need to really make sure that people feel like, A, there's not that much change, it's really not that bad, and to your point, that we need to make sure that we're making benefits that come back to the community as well.
Yeah, so I really, Desnes consulted recently on community benefits and making those mandatory, which I field fully support. But that wasn't going to come in until 2029 earliest if it happens. And, you know, hopefully the message you've got across now is things need to happen quick to hit targets. And so there's a long way to go on it in terms of how do you define a community? What does the community really want? And so it's definitely something that needs to be done. It needs a lot of collaboration, you know, like GB Energy being involved in things. I think that really could be a thing, understanding actually what the community wants. But yeah, I think community benefits could and should be a really big thing. And then also to tie it back to my planning resource point, you know, these community benefit pots, they could be at different levels. So you could have the local level of like, okay, local community, you are actually impacted. And so, you know, here is some compensation for that. But also regional pot, here local authority, fund your planners, upskill, like make planning cool again. Like,
yeah, yeah, make planning cool again. I don't, I like, yes. I
mean, I've always thought it was cool, but
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was definitely within the statement, wasn't it? And look, I mean, look, if we can get money coming out of battery solar wind deployment that's also filling in potholes, that's gonna be really sensationalist.
Well, that's the thing of like, you know, find people's why of like, you know, are the local communities really upset about their potholes? Great, like we want help.
Great. I love it. And then one last part on which kind of does come up in other episodes, and I'm interested to kind of get your take on it, just the skills for delivering batteries on sites. So is this something that you come up against where you think, right, this battery is now ready to go. I've spent millions to this point. We've done all of the work to get this battery to this point, and now we need someone who is a sort of skilled electrician or a wirer, whatever it might be, to actually deliver this project and get it to go live. Do you think we have enough people who can cover that, or is it kind of a space where it's crying out for more support?
Yeah, today it's not been something that we've struggled with, but I think to go back to my earlier point in terms of like planning, that's definitely an area that needs more skills. And then also if you look at the industry as a whole, so look outside of just batteries and the renewables energy, the amount of new people that we need coming into that space to be able to deliver what we actually say that we want to do is huge. And so within that, I think STEM and particularly women in STEM is something that I'm very passionate about. And I think that feeds quite nicely into that.
So let's talk about that. How do we get more women into these engineering roles, into the battery space, into these kind of critical parts of delivering this transition?
Yeah, I completely agree. So there aren't enough women in STEM. Powerful Women is a organization set up to sort of try and help this, like bring this up more. And they've set targets. So they want 40% of women in middle management or leadership by 2030. And that just isn't happening. Like there has been progress, but it's just glacial. And so not only is it important, as I've said, to, you know, make sure that the skills are there, it's important for companies too, right? Like you've still got all male boards. Like company, you're going to perform better if you've got a diverse skill set there. And so they've actually just recently released their sort of state of the nation, which they do each year. I think they said to hit the targets that they want to hit, the top 100 companies each need to recruit 5 females into leadership roles and 38 females into middle management roles to get there. So you know, that's quite the leap.
Mm.
But like, I think there's stuff that we can do about it. And I think it falls into two categories. One is like, pipeline of make sure that the skill is actually there and coming up. And then the second is retention and opportunities for females who are in the industry.
Totally agree. I think some of the stats for much larger businesses always feel tricky for me because obviously Modo as a business, we're sort of 70, 80 people. Field is of a similar size, I would say.
Bigger now.
Bigger, of course. Of course you're bigger. God, that was a mistake. yeah, just kind of this kind of concept of 28 middle managers feels like a lot.
Sure.
So how does a small business think about this, or a smaller business think about this?
So to go back to then each of those areas. So in terms of pipeline, there are like outreach programs that you can do. So I personally am a STEM ambassador. So STEM learning is a program that's set up. And that means that you volunteer some of your time to work with young adults, young people, and just like bring STEM to life for them, like help them understand what the opportunities are and also like fulfill their potential. So for example, I did an assembly recently at my local primary school for their World Science Day. And it's because ask them, what is a scientist? Oh, it's a male in a lab coat. And when I said to them I was a scientist, honestly, I felt like a celebrity. They were like, an actual scientist lives around the corner from us. And so just that sort of, you know, myth busting, but also role model thing. So that's something that, you know, I think everyone can do. Something that Fields specifically has done that I championed was as a sort of a quasi-community benefit. We also launched a schools program. So it's like an educational pack that we developed with a company to sort of, again, bring the renewables energy to life of what do careers in renewable energy look like? What skill sets might you have to have to go into each of those things? And then we targeted that at schools in close proximity to our sites. And then, so that successfully launched for the school year last year and reached over 2,500 pupils over last year. And then now that's going to be done annually, but this year we've sort of upgraded it. And sort of as well as the schools pack, we're turning it into like a parent pack so that, like, you know, a parent can also help advise their child on, you know, this is what you could do if you're interested in that.
Yeah, I love this. This is all like really well thought through, turning things into action. I would maybe also add in kind of an extra bit that if you are someone who is looking at the space and thinking, God, is energy for me, or is that just for this particular type of person? Just talking about Modo Energy's transmission, we've had a whole range of guests on. Take a look, have a look, see what episodes they've done, have a listen to what they do. If it sounds interesting, then yeah, you can definitely go and do it.
Yeah, yeah. And that's in this pack, is it doesn't just look at, you know, scientists who've come into it. Like, you can work in finance, but still want to make a difference in the renewable energy space. So there's a whole way so that you can get involved in it.
And this is all sort of on YouTube now. You don't have to be kind of right place, right time, you know, nephew or niece of X. You know, you can actually just go to YouTube and you can kind of experience this. So yeah. I think it's really important work. Now, I know we have two final questions, one of which is a sort of contrarian opinion, of which you've released that early. So let's go to just the final question, which is there anything you'd like to plug?
It's really cheesy, but it's true. And it's Field. Field is a vibe. I love my job and I realize I am very fortunate to be able to say that. But, you know, looking back on what's happened in 2 years since AMIC came on, we have done so much. So we have four values, and one of those is move fast. You know, and we've really done it. And I was a really early joiner at Field. When we were going out to our first battery tender, and we were sort of begging tenderers, like, you know, please come work with us. And like you say, we were in a Shoreditch office full of dogs and trees. And now can go to events, you say you work for Field, and people are like, oh yeah, like, yeah, I know you. And so I think because we've moved fast and we've shown that we're doing things, that's attracted people. You know, and people, again, also want to be involved in the energy transition. We're such a great team that's surrounded by so much talent that it's also not threatening. It's sort of, you want to bring your A game, but also everyone's sharing knowledge, we're innovating and you're learning. It's a great place.
Would second this. Everything we do with Field is great. Please do check out the company if you're looking at roles in the space. Bex, you've been a fantastic guest. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks,
and coming on Transmission.
Thanks.